a footnote or right. something of that type.
Well, what exactly was this experiment?
Well, I'm trying to pinpoint the year. I'd have to think about that a bit. But it was around 1934, I presume. And I was a postdoctoral research associate in the physics department at the University of Michigan, working on the cyclotron. And one of the other students there, Arthur Adell, approached me to inquire if I'd give him some help setting up some equipment to look for radio waves from the sun. He had a belief that in the region of sunspots, due to the motions involved, the particle velocities, likely presence of strong magnetic fields there, mm-hmm. that there might be radio emission. And coincident with that, there was a 1 meter radio apparatus available in the department, which Cleeton and Williams had built, with which they had used for the detection of the 1.3 centimeter ammonia line.
I see.
And they had a gas cell which they suspended between 2 1-meter diameter World War I searchlight parabolic reflectors. And they
I see.
Transmitted the waves in this beam between the two reflectors, and we proposed to use the one reflector with a receiving equipment, a crystal detector and galvanometer, and see if we could detect any radio emission from the sun. Well, we made the attempt and our results were negative, but the idea behind it was sound. The problem was that our equipment, which was about the best that the state of the art afforded at the time, was about 60 dB too insensitive.
What exactly was the receiver?
It was just simply a crystal rectifier, with connected directly to a very sensitive microampere type galvanometer,
mm-hmm.
which was adequate to pick up the radio emission from the magnetron tubes that Cleeton had built to transmit through the gas bank
right.
holding the ammonia. But
the ammonia work was published, I suppose, so I can find
yes.
a description of the
yes,
thing
that,
there.
Yes, that is right. There's this article by Cleeton and Williams on that.
And
I am not exactly sure about my date. It may have been a year later than this, but it was right in there. I'd have to check that. It's in
and
the mid-30s.
Was he looking for activity associated with a flare or only with sunspots?
Well, our beam was wide enough that all we could pick up was the sun. We couldn't have distinguished it. Just radio emission from the sun at centimeter wavelengths,
right.
that's all.
You weren't waiting for a flare
no.
and then,
no.
then looking.
And it's curious because at the time I was also doing some work at 5 meter wavelengths with my amateur radio equipment. I was developing some types of antennas, beam antennas as a matter of fact. And with the state of the art and receivers at 5 meters wavelength and one of my beam antennas, I had a better chance of picking up emission from the sun at that time.
Right.
Except that it happened to be at a sunspot minimum.
Right.
However, if I'd done that experiment, a few years later at a sunspot maximum, then the chances might have been pretty good. So you see, you needed not only the idea, but you needed to do it at the proper wavelength and at the proper time in the spot cycle to make it pay off. And Jansky, as a matter of fact, with his equipment, would probably have detected the sun if he had been operating during spot maximum.
That's right. And this was post-Jansky, your solar attempt. So you were influenced by the fact that
This is quite likely, yes, that since radio waves, extraterrestrial waves, had been detected, and that, Jansky's idea at the time was that they were from... could very likely be from radiation from stars,
right?
Except that he didn't detect any from the sun, and therefore, unless the sun were not a typical star, it meant that it probably came from the interstellar medium,
right?
And in that respect, he was correct.
Did you know of any other attempts earlier or simultaneous to detect the sun at this time?
No.
And do you know of any other attempts pre-World War II?
No.
So that was one incursion, but when was the next time that you got involved in radio astronomy?
Well, during the war, I was working at the Naval Ordnance Laboratory in Washington. We were doing degaussing, that is, the protection of ships against magnetic mines. And this was a laboratory which had been assembled, the personnel had been assembled very quickly, actually somewhat before the United States got involved in the war, in order to develop methods to protect ships against magnetic mines.
The Lend-Lease thing? Going to England and so forth?
No, this was... protect any of the ships, because... The waters around England were being mined with these, and they were very difficult to combat. Well, one of the other men recruited for the Naval Ordnance Laboratory was Groot Reber.
I see.
And we worked in the laboratory long hours, but when we were out of the laboratory, because we were working on the top secret project, we refrained from saying anything about that. For a topic of conversation, Reber turned to his experiments in radio astronomy, and what he was doing and had done, and it was a fascinating story. And if there hadn't been a war and I had been involved, I would have liked to have done something about it right then, build a radio telescope or work on some of this. So it was not until after the war...
Let me just ask now, but Reber did observations in 42, 3, 4, and so he must have gone back very soon.
Yes, he was at the Naval Ordnance Laboratory for a period, and then he returned to Chicago... the Chicago area. He lived in Wheaton, Illinois, and he worked at one of the large radio companies in the Chicago area.
Right. But you stayed on at the lab throughout the war.
But what?
You stayed at the lab throughout the war.
Yes. Well, no, I was at Naval Ordnance Laboratory from 41, 42. I was there 3 years, and then the last 3 years of the war, I was at the Radio Research Laboratory at Harvard University.
What was its purpose?
At NOL, we were working on protection against magnetic mines. This was a countermeasure activity. And at Harvard, we were doing radar countermeasures, protection against radar, means of nullifying the value of radar equipment.
And I suppose this was in close conjunction with the Rad Lab at MIT?
They were operated entirely separately, and we knew about their radars because we could pick them up and working out ways of jamming them and other things, but they didn't know too much about our work. It was that kind of arrangement. I came to Ohio State after the war, and I was deeply engaged in starting some courses in electromagnetic theory and teaching. And it wasn't for several years after I came that I was able to do any serious work about radio astronomy. But in the early 50s...
But you were following it, I suppose, all this time.
Well, I had heard about some things that were being done, mostly in England and Australia.
Right.
And so about 1951, I presume, would be pretty close to it. I started work with a graduate student or two in building an array of helical antennas to detect, well, the sun and what other objects we might be able to receive with the equipment that we had.
What specifically was going to be the improvement in this antenna versus previous solar observations? What would it enable you to do?
I don't think that we had any particular definite objective in mind. We just wanted to start observations, mm-hmm. determine what you needed from a more empirical basis.
Uh-huh.
At the time we started, there were only two other universities in the United States that had done any work in radio astronomy. Been some work at Harvard and Cornell.
Right.
And
you just wanted to get in the game, you're saying.
We wanted to start and see what we needed.
Yeah.
A few years earlier, I had discovered, or the word invented is probably more appropriate, a new antenna, the helical antenna, which is a circularly polarized antenna, a broadband antenna, has very low mutual impedance so that it can be used in large arrays very easily. It has many highly desirable features. And not knowing how many we would need, we started with an array of a dozen or so of these helices on a tiltable ground plane so that we could operate it as a meridian transit instrument. And our funding was modest, and we one of the first steps that, well, the initial one that got us started was that there was, we received a grant from a university fund for about $2,000, and I converted that almost 100% into steel. A couple tons of steel, angle iron, and beams, and with students working part-time, afternoons and weekends, we put this telescope together. We wound all the helices and put them on. We got some receiving equipment,
mm-hmm.
and found we could first detect the sun, then Cassiopeia A, Cygnus A, other radio sources. We realized that if we added more helices, we could get more mm-hmm. sources, and we just continued on this for a period of a year or so, gradually adding more till we had almost 100. Actually, an array of 96 helical antennas on a big flat steel tiltable structure, 160 feet long and about 22 feet wide.
Mm.
It was one of the world's big radio telescopes
right.
at the time, and with that we were able to detect the order of 100 or so radio sources.
Over what period was the antenna built now?
And the antenna was built in the period starting 51 to 53, mm-hmm. 1951 to 1953.
And you published these results, I assume?
Well, we did some. The one of the most complete things we did was a survey of the sky at the wavelength we were operating, about 250 megahertz at that frequency. That's about 1.3 meters. And we made a survey of the whole sky that we could reach with this, and published this map, also indicating on it, showing the position of radio sources that mm-hmm. could be picked up, the discrete sources.
Right.
But it was a beautiful map in the sense that you could see the galaxy so clear and so strongly. And we, in the year that this came out, which was about 1955 perhaps or something like that, Harlow Shapley picked it as one of the year's 10 most outstanding accomplishments in astronomy.
I see.
Which gave us a real boost and impetus, and there was a lot of interest by many people in this new area of radio astronomy. And
this was the map that has been made into an intensity display also.
Yeah, we took that and converted the contour map into shades of light and black, and so we have subsequently published it as an impression of how the sky would look if your eyes were sensitive to radio waves instead
right.
of light. And it's really a beautiful picture.
Right.
And gives you, in a glance, the great difference between the radio sky and the optical one. Well,
what about your radio source? You said you detected 100 sources. Did you publish a source
list?
We
published a number of these, well, and some of them. There were none of them that were really discoveries on our part. It was a matter of confirming
mm-hmm.
the observations that had been made by other observatories, but we were operating at a different wavelength, and so
right.
by our measuring the flux density there, we were able to put another point on the radio spectra. We got interested early in the game on a spectra of radio
mm-hmm.
sources. This apparatus, or this radio telescope, is located on some property owned by the Agricultural College of the university, and it was not too far from the main campus of Ohio State University, and in an area that was rapidly developing and urbanizing.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that if we wanted to continue our work and make with a bigger telescope, it would be better to locate further away. So
right.
I was encouraged to consider a site near the Perkins Optical Observatory, which is near the town of Delaware, Ohio, about 20 miles north of Columbus, by Dr. Jeffrey Keller, who was at that time director of the Perkins Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
The astronomy department at OSU was still a part of physics. It was the Department of Physics and Astronomy. And the Perkins Observatory is owned by Ohio Wesleyan University. But Ohio Wesleyan is an undergraduate school, and Perkins Observatory had this big optical telescope when it was built some years earlier. It was the third largest telescope in the world, I think, 69-inch, and strictly a research instrument. So some years earlier, this would be probably in the early 50s, Ohio Wesleyan made arrangements with Ohio State to staff and operate the telescope.
I see.
And I talked with the administration of Ohio Wesleyan about some land for radio telescope, and they were very cooperative. And so I got, they made available to us about a 20-acre tract near the Perkins Observatory where we could build our radio telescope. And the most attractive feature of the whole thing was that this was in the middle of a big tract of land owned and controlled by Ohio Wesleyan, which we felt, or I felt, might serve as a buffer against encroachment by sources of interference. So about 1956, we started construction of a bigger telescope. And I had been contemplating a design of a larger instrument and evolved one which has a large fixed standing parabola and a tiltable flat reflector joined by a ground plane. The whole motivation of it is to get the largest aperture possible at per dollar of cost.
Right.
And so if you keep the instrument close to the ground, you reduce the height.
Right.
Cost usually goes up as height cubed, at least. And
and this was a unique design, was it not? That
it
you
was
came
a
up
unique
with?
Design, right. Yes. It has been adopted by others. In France, a couple of telescopes have been built of this design,
right.
One of them considerably bigger than ours.
Let me just ask, did you have any contact with optical astronomers at all during the first few years?
Well, I mentioned Dr. Jeffrey Keller.
Right.
Yes, I did, and the astronomy department was interested. I was made professor of physics, astronomy, and electrical engineering. So I had appointment in all three departments.
So there was an integration, even at that early stage?
Yes.
Hmm.
The funding for our work came out of electrical engineering, but at the intellectual level and at the level of the astronomy and the work being done, well, it was closely integrated with the optical astronomy. Unfortunately, the climate in Ohio had an adverse effect in the interests of the optical astronomers for the most part. I mean, they were interested, but none of, in the radio astronomy, but none of them had research or were doing work in areas that turned out to be directly related to optical astronomy, and this related to radio astronomy.
Right, right.
And this is really a kind of a curious thing. Because of the poor climate, poor seeing in Ohio, the optical work had concentrated on spectra of bright stars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are have turned out to be not very good radio emitters. If we'd had better seeing there, it might have been that some of them would have been interested in nebulosities.
Right.
And those are the things that you see in the early days we
right.
began to identify with radio sources. So there wasn't direct the opportunity for direct collaboration.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, there was interest, and we participated in their colloquia and discussions, and I sought advice on the interpretation of our results. And
well, that's interesting, because many other places there really wasn't much contact at all in the early 50s between the optical and radio people. But now back to your dish, that your large.
Well, we
the money from that came from where? ONR?
No, about 1957, I think, somewhere in there. We began to get a small amount, maybe 56, from the National Science Foundation, which allowed us to make some preliminary moves. And For a number of years, we got funding from the NSF, which allowed us to proceed with the construction of this large telescope, the standing parabola,
mm-hmm.
360 feet long, 70 feet high, and a tiltable flat reflector. About the same length, but 100 feet in slant height, and connected by an aluminum-covered ground plane 3.5 acres in extent.
Right.
Well, this construction went on rather slowly over a period of many years, because this is unique in the following respect. In many institutions, instruments have been built by having someone write a set of specifications and then getting people, manufacturers, to bid, getting
right.
the money and having it constructed. Here, we developed, first of all, the design ourselves, and we did all the construction in-house using students working part-time.
Mm.
For most of the work. These were not just engineering students. They came from many different departments in the university. Turned out that our best welder had been a high steel worker in earlier years, and a very expert welder.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pre-dental student. And he taught other students welding. We mm-hmm. had a Saturday morning class until we got about a dozen students up to a certain level of competence
mm-hmm.
in welding. And we had students who were in industrial engineering who specialized in time and motion studies, and they systematized the operation to make it as efficient as possible. And we just worked away at this for quite a few years. It was slow, steady, tedious work getting this telescope built and put together, but we...
When was it finally finished?
We started in 56. By 63, we had most of it constructed, and by that time, we were beginning to turn our attention to getting receivers.
Well,
and one of the OSU graduates in electrical engineering had gone with Western Electric and became preeminent in the development and design of parametric amplifiers. And did I say Western Electric?
Yes.
I meant Bell Telephone Laboratories.
Who was this?
Mickey Wainahara. Mickey is his nickname. His last name is Wainahara, Uenohara. And this is a type of amplifier, parametric amplifier, very low noise. And the Bell Labs was willing to put one of these amplifiers together for us. If we bought the basic components that went in. This was Wayne Harris Group built it, and I think we took delivery on that about 1963, which gave us as low a noise receiver as in operation anywhere at the time.
How low noise was it?
It was, the receiver itself was probably 40, 50 degree temperature, very low noise.
At what frequency?
1400 megahertz.
And the dish was designed to operate to
well,
how short a wavelength?
We did not know exactly how short it would go, but it was designed to go at least as short as 21 centimeters. Has turned out it can be used very usefully to about 10 centimeter wavelength.
Before you go any further, I had a couple other questions. Were there any particular troubles besides essentially just the slow pace that things went at in the design of the telescope that you didn't foresee?
We had lots of troubles. I mean, it's a long, tedious process, many mechanical problems achieving the getting a satisfactory design. Years of really slogging through the mud at the site. It's a big, big site with all the construction going on, and the fact that it was going on at a slow pace. Nevertheless, we got
none of them were
progressed.
So serious that they couldn't be surmounted anyway.
Well, it just took patience and perseverance, yeah. and a lot of that. That is, it took us longer than we had anticipated, but we had no set timetable when we started. We got it done when we got it done, and we made many preliminary observations with the telescope over a number of years, and it wasn't until about 1966 when we put on a new reflecting surface, a good screen surface on the telescope, that we got the efficiency up to the point where it warranted starting on a big sky survey. And that's what we started on at about that time, and that continued for many years. We have just completed that within the last year.
I'm ending the history around 65 or so, because it just gets out of hand after that, but I still have a few other questions. What was the efficiency initially at 21 centimeters? Or?
Well, the efficiency there was lower than we had hoped. It was less than 50%, and after we got the new screen on, we got it up around 60%, which is about as much as you could expect, considering the fact you have to use tapered illumination to reduce side lobes. If you want to aim for 100% efficiency, your side lobes would get you in big trouble.
Were you able to do any preliminary observations during these 7 years that it was being built?
Oh, yes. We had a lot of publications on particular findings. We published a preliminary list of always with maps. That is, our surveys have been unique in that they are accompanied by contour maps of the sky. Not just a list of objects. And typically on these maps we plot the positions of all radio sources previously cataloged by other observatories. So in a glance, when you look at this map, you see not only our observational results, but everything that is known about the radio sky, and that's what makes these quite useful.
Right. What about the helix array? Did it just sort of die when you began on this?
Well,
sort of thing?
After we began to get in operation at the new site up near Delaware, we just decommissioned it. But it was a very useful instrument for the period that we had it going. There are a few sidelights about this research and this sky survey. We didn't know exactly how many sources we would detect, but it turns out that we had found about 20,000 radio sources at flux densities above about 0.2 of a Jansky at 1400 megahertz in the sky, which we have surveyed between minus 35 degrees to plus 65 degrees in declination. And at the present time, this is the largest, deepest radio survey that has ever been made. And out of this have come many very interesting sources that we noticed from even the very first installments from this survey, that we were picking up quite strong sources at 1400 megahertz that were not cataloged at all in lower frequency surveys. And the reason for this was that these objects had flat spectrum and were just too weak to be picked up at the lower frequency, so that we early on started investigating these objects at higher frequencies than we could operate in a cooperative program with radio astronomers in Canada at the Algonquin Radio Observatory, primarily with Dr. Brian Andrew there. And
And these have turned out to be some quite...
And some of these objects have turned out to be extremely unusual, like OJ-287 is
right.
One of the prototype erratic optical variables. It's a BL LAC type
right.
object.
And the high redshift quasars.
And then we have found some very high redshift quasars, the two that hold the redshift record at the present time, OH-471, with a redshift of 3.40, and OQ-172 with a redshift of 3.53, are objects that we found that were in no other
right.
surveys at all, and might even now not have been really investigated.
Right.
But when we found them in our survey, realized they weren't in lower frequency ones, we immediately concentrated on them and drew attention to them as being unusual. We got good enough positions at Algonquin to identify them with radio with optical objects.
Right.
And this got some optical astronomers interested in obtaining optical spectra and finding that they did have big redshifts.
Going back to 56, was your motivation an all-sky high frequency for that time survey?
Well, yes. At that time, we felt that with this big instrument, since it was a survey type of instrument, a meridian transit instrument, which couldn't be turned at will to look east or west of the meridian at this or that, that the best use for this type of instrument
mm-hmm.
is a survey where you know you're going to look at the whole sky sooner or later, so what you're looking at the moment doesn't matter, and
right.
you just go at it systematically. And this was our main primary objective.
And so you've just now, almost 20 years later, finally completed that, I guess.
Well, I guess that's right. I hadn't realized it's so darn long.
Were you influenced at all by the log N, log S controversy, which was going just as you started this dish? Did you think that this might help?
We have invested, yes, we thought it would. This is an elusive will-o'-the-wisp that
right.
It's... We're getting closer to it, but it's we have done work on this, and it's very interesting.
But that was part of your original motivation also.
Yeah. Now, you must realize that in connection with this, there have been many students working with me, graduate students and undergraduate students, and the names of these people will be in these publication
right.
list. And a couple of them I'd like to mention is H.C. Coe, Dr. Coe.
Is he still at Ohio State?
Yes, he's still at Ohio State. He worked on the earliest surveys with the Helix telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Nash worked on some of the earlier surveys with the big telescope, the parabola type. And he... did the bulk of the actual mechanical design on many of the structures. We worked together on that. He's an electrical engineer, but also a very good mechanical engineer by the time he got through. And Dr. Robert Dixon, who is now associate director of our radio observatory,
mm-hmm.
And who is... very expert in the field of computers and programming, got our big sky survey worked out so that the data reduction could be done effectively
right.
with computer programs to reduce the data, average records, discriminate against interference, and come up with a source list and actually computer plotted maps of
right.
the sky that we had surveyed, so that these and many other people working together carried out the actual work.
Would you mind if I asked you about the Venus bursts, which you thought you had at one point?
Yeah.
What were they, actually?
They were terrestrial interference. And I was, how should I say, because of the fact, well, I had an instrument working which this was soon after the Jupiter burst had been picked up by Burke and Franklin, and we detected Jupiter on this, and a natural follow-up, well, let's look at the other planets. Well, I never got anything from Mars, because I could look at Mars at night when the sun was down, but Venus is a tough one, because it's usually only up observable when the sun is also up. And due to solar interference and also more of the daytime radio interference, it was simply a matter of seeing some bursts there that looked like they would correlate, that were interference of a solar type and or terrestrial interference, and really not Venusian in origin.
I've heard someone say that you actually pinned it down as to where this was coming from.
No.
You never did?
No.
Then what finally convinced you that it wasn't real?
Well, I just couldn't repeat.
I see.
Could not repeat the experiments.
And so, were the bursts a side lobe effect, the side lobe going on and off the sun, do you think, or were they actual solar bursts?
They were probably related to a solar burst in side lobes of the antenna. In other words, a small amount of solar interference could have just been overriding.
Right. And another thing that I'd like to get the straight story on, so to speak, is I think there was a publication about the same time about a variable radio source whose flux was supposed to vary with time, from the Ohio State Observatory. Is this correct?
We published a report about what appeared to be a very variable flux density on a particular source that we had seen for, well, I'd have to get the publication, look it over carefully. I don't know whether we saw it more than one day. If it had been only for a single day, I mean, we would have discounted it as interference, but it seemed to be there for a day or two and then was gone. We were scanning with the Helix array, and we didn't know. That is, we weren't drawing any conclusions, but we thought, well, if this is real, this is very interesting, and I think we ought to publish it, because it may alert others to look for similar things. So we didn't publish it with the idea that we had indeed a variable source. It was that here were some observations, maybe it was a variable source. And it could have been. It could have been a flare type or something. Nobody knows.
And this was at a time when there were no variable sources
except
for the Sun and Jupiter.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And in fact, it wasn't until 65 when there were others found.
But probability is that it could have been an interference effect, too. And in those early days, there were so many things that we hadn't yet sorted out. And when looking the records over, we were trying to find everything we could, and some of these had other explanations.
Well, I think that covers it quite well, unless you have any other comments you'd like to make.
No, I think...
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hans, the interview with John Krauss on 25th March 75 at the AAS meeting in Bloomington. And this is the end of the tape.